You're listening to Clearcast, the real estate fintech podcast from Clear Capital. Each month, your co-hosts Keenan Chen and Jeff Allen will bring you compelling stories and revolutionary ideas from the people and companies at the intersection of real estate, finance, and technology. Want to be a guest on the show or have an idea for an episode? Email marketing@clearcapital.com and let us know. And now, here's the show.
Well, hello, everyone. Welcome to our first episode of 2024, which is actually episode 39. Wow, Clearcast is about to turn 40. So let's pretend that it's actually episode 29. And on this this first episode, we're going to do something a little different. I'm super excited to bring in our first guest host. Since Jeff is off doing amazing things with Kubikasa, but also we wanted to bring in some talent from the rest of the industry to comment on where things are going, and I get to bring in my friend here today, Jeremy Potter, who you already know, but you know Jeremy is a true industry thought leader. He's got 11 years plus experience in mortgage. He's got all kinds of various talented skill sets, from being an attorney to being product to being a visionary. And you know, he's been doing some stuff with Title recently, as well as a pretty amazing background with Rocket and Stabby and others. Jeremy, I'm so glad you could be here to hang out. Thanks.
Thank you, Keenan. Great to be here. I'm no Jeff Allen, but I'll do my best.
And that's actually great for all of us. Jeff can't be here to defend himself, so I get to make fun of him, as I usually do. But great to have you on it. And so, you know, what we're gonna do today is talk a little bit about, you know, where the industry is at here in the beginning of the year. We're almost at the end of February here, as always, the industry is full of surprises and full of fun challenges that we get to tackle. And so what we thought we'd cover is, like, where are things at? What are some of the trends that we're seeing, and what are some of the emerging solutions that are catching our eye? So what I'll start off with today is something we just saw on realtor.com, which speaks to the demand that's still there even while mortgage rates are remaining high. They're not coming down as fast as we'd all like. We saw some good movement in January and December, but what realtor.com said was that nearly 40% of potential buyers would find a home purchase feasible if mortgage rates fell below 6%. So there's this kind of huge trough of potential buyers that don't need a lot, but if they came down below 6%, they'd be ready to jump in. And then there's an additional 32% of buyers would be willing to purchase if rates drop below 5%. So we're sitting here high sixes right now. Jeremy, what do you think? What are you hearing out there? Do you think that demand is still there right now, or are people just kind of waiting in the sidelines to jump in should rate cuts start to show up?
It seems like demand is always going to be there to some degree. And what we're really talking about with the numbers in that survey are how many more people join, like, actively shopping as a result of it getting $1,500, $2,500, or $3,000 a month more affordable or more attainable. So it's really just growing the group that's actively shopping. Because it sounds to me like what those numbers tell me is everybody wants to be in the game, and they're sort of dancing on the line of, am I actively shopping or just passively considering, based on some probably psychological impact of the rates, based on what their research, you know, as they were watching the rates climb and their experience. But then, you know, if it got just a little bit better, I'll take my chance. I'll dump it. To me, that's all demand. That's all positive demand from our industry's perspective. It's just a matter of when people are shopping versus watching.
Yeah. And that trough of folks that would like to buy, but are just kind of kept out of it right now is exasperated by the strength of home values as well. I mean, it's interesting to see that because of the limited supply, I mean, we're still seeing appreciation year over year. There's less sales happening, but there's still so few homes available that we're seeing, you know, prices stay pretty stubborn. You know, speaking of home sales, you know, this year so far, we're seeing, we saw some good growth in January, 3.1% increase for existing home sales, but over December, but over last year, a year from now, we actually saw a decline of home sales, 1.7% decline year over year. So these rates are still impacting folks that want to stay in their homes with their low mortgage rates.
Yeah, I think one of the big things that does have an influence on consumer behavior is when housing news sort of shifts into being mainstream news as well. You know, you and I talk about this stuff all the time, and we're constantly following these trends. But increasingly, I think we're seeing the mainstream media pick up on housing demand, supply and demand, especially. What's going on? Is this going to change? You know, we've had these periods where the some of the demand curve, or even really supply, has either plateaued or at least aligned with other factors that say it's somewhat balanced, or what we might expect in the context of being short homes by anywhere from 2 to 6 million, depending on which metric you use for how many homes short we are. But even within that, you see some patterns. Right now, we're seeing a pattern where a lot of policymakers, politicians, journalists are picking up on housing as a critical issue. So yeah. I think that also tells you a lot about those existing homeowners and what they're reading and seeing. I would assume, being one, that they hear, oh, my house continues to appreciate in value. Mortgage rates remain out of reach if I wanted to buy another house, downsize or whatever. So I don't need to tune back in until something changes, so to speak. That's a real problem. That's a real bummer for first-time home buyers.
Yeah, I'm getting more media reach outs right now on home equity lending than I am on mortgage, if that tells you something right there. The journalists are more interested in covering, you know, home equity rates. They're not even asking about mortgage rates anymore until something changes, I think.
Well, and you've got this storyline. You know, I like tracking some of the data, the Urban Institute's monthly chart book, which tells you what share of this $44-ish trillion market is home equity. And that just continues to grow. And the share that's mortgage debt remains relatively stable over the last year. And as a result of that, I think whether it's journalists or, you know, new platforms and new products or existing mortgage platforms trying to look for new ways to reach out to their service portfolio, home equity is a bigger story because that's where, quote unquote, the action is or could be from both a sales and product perspective.
Okay, so we know that affordability is a challenge, and it doesn't seem to be getting noticeably better. You know, we're kind of holding, and nowhere is that more apparent than in California, where I live. You know, just looking at a recent stat that, depending on which source you look at, but only 15 or 16% of home buyers in California can afford a median priced home. And it still shocks me when I, you know, when I think about that, like such a small percentage there. So let's talk about what's being done to address this. You know, are you hearing of anything being done? I guess maybe starting at the government level, and more of the institutional agencies. What's being done to address affordability right now?
Well, if you look at some of like the main, like I said, the mainstream media picking up on this, I think they're asking a good question to politicians and policymakers. Should we be using different levers? Should we be using different programs? I think a lot of times you get into scenarios like this, and it's pretty normal to pour money into the programs that you're familiar with rather than having to create something totally new. And so there was an op-ed recently, CNN.com, pretty mainstream media there, down the middle. And, you know, and Jim Parrott and Mark Zandi were arguing, well, we've got LIHTC structure for multifamily lower cost rental, let's use it for single family, right? We've got different tax incentivized or tax advantaged accounts, whether it's a 401k for retirement or a Roth IRA for investing. Let's do that for home ownership and down payment. So to me, that's an example of somebody kind of trying to use the mainstream media to reach policymakers and politicians to say, like, hey, you're familiar with this. Let's go just a little bit more innovative, just right outside of the existing use of that, to use it for this, to hope that that makes a dent or hope that that makes a difference. I definitely wouldn't say that's a bad call. I would just say that's like a very marginal approach, right? Let's do this thing that we know. Let's do it a little bit wider or a little bit different for the single family space than some other space and see if that works. So that's one, I would say that's one way we're hearing or seeing somebody approach this problem. I think the other way I would put in a much broader category of like necessity is the mother of invention, which says this thing is getting pretty rapidly out of control if you believe home ownership is the path to generational wealth for an entire generation. And if you believe that, we've got to rapidly innovate a couple of more paths, on-ramps or products to address this, because it isn't going to be the policy, politicians or existing infrastructure that gets there in enough time as this cohort of, say, millennials, for instance, age not just into home ownership age, beyond what is traditionally home ownership age. And so I think we're seeing a lot more scrambling is maybe a good word, but it's certainly fun to watch private industry try to innovate around the problem, because there hasn't really been a lot of clarity on housing, home ownership in particular, but housing generally at the federal level more recently.
Yeah, I mean, I think it'd be good to go into some of those. I've been fascinated by, honestly, you know, within the prop tech, you know, industry. Obviously, you know, they took a pretty big hit last year in terms of the availability of funding from the VC community and others to scale some of these ideas, but yet folks are still going for it. You know, there's still a number of founders with great ideas, and let's talk about some of these models that we're seeing, you know, prop up that are trying to solve, you know, affordability. You know, actually, you could probably help us define some of these things. So we hear about things like shared equity. Like, when you hear shared equity, what does that mean to you as an approach?
Yeah, you know, the shared equity always in my mind gets used a lot for the consumer that's trying to buy their first house and uses funds to achieve that, usually 10 or 20% of the home value of the home price that they get from a usually institutional partner who's going to own that portion of the equity of the home, as opposed to finding a second lien or mom and dad's money to make that down payment, right? So if I don't go and get down payment assistance, or I don't use mom and dad's money for the down payment, I'm actually going to use this other cash and they're going to share in the equity and the appreciation of the home with me. And that's how first-time home buyers. So it's not only that, but that tends to be where it's used most often, is in that the purchase origination space for shared equity. But the reality is, if you zoom out a step, shared equity is any investment in the home along with the owner. I use the first-time home buyer example because I think that's where it gets attached quite a bit, especially right now. But it does actually just mean the other version too, which is an existing homeowner selling some of their available home equity. But that tends to be a different category that we'll get to, that sort of home equity investment, home equity agreement type bucket. But the reality is both are existing and in fact growing over the last quarter or so.
Well, let's go there. Let's go to home equity investment, because we're seeing that both as a way to address what we talked about earlier, which is the growing amount of equity available to people that are stuck in place, if you will, or locked in and want to make improvements. But it's starting to be looked at for home buying as well. So what's home equity investment?
Those are the platforms you would see out there approaching existing homeowners, saying you don't have to borrow money or you don't have to attach debt to your existing home equity, HELOC being the best example of that. You don't have to do a debt side product in order to get cash for this asset you have. You own this much of your home. Maybe it's 100%, maybe it's 80%, maybe it's 50%, but we will give you cash for a percentage of your ownership interest, and then we'll own that portion. And the whole ball game tends to be, what are the terms of that arrangement? Is it we're in this together and I own 10%, the company owns 10% with the homeowner, and let's see what happens. As the home continues to appreciate, I get my 10% grows. Some cases it's I own 10% of the equity, and then also as the home grows, I own a greater percentage of the growth. Maybe I own 30% of the appreciation after my investment, and then everything in between. Terms and conditions end up being the whole ball game in the home equity investment, home equity agreement space. What am I getting? What's my deal? It's sort of like an interest rate would be on the mortgage side. What's my interest rate look like? Should I lock in today? That's similar questions happening on the HEI, HEA space, but it tends to be, what does the future terms of this agreement look like?
So, I mean, there's some models that are maybe already available today and backed by, you can get a conforming loan with them. One of those is co-ownership and co-buying, right? I mean, what are we seeing in that space of just going in with people you already know to buy a home together?
I like that as a third bucket. I don't know about you, Keenan, but that to me feels like a great like third categorization here to say, yeah, is that fractional ownership? Is that shared equity? Of course, absolutely it is. Mm-hmm. And it is then the actual occupants of the house sharing the equity amongst themselves. The only reason we tend to not look at other mortgages that way is it's a family unit of some sort, right? It's maybe spouses, for instance, or cohabitating partners or what have you. And the example where you're using this third category is just, we're seeing a rise both in platforms and in demand for friends buying a house together, for business partner arrangement as well. We're seeing that. I'm going to buy a building or a larger space, and we're going to have a business and we're going to live there. Those types of things. So co-buy, co-investment, we see those companies. And I've actually seen two trends with those that I find fascinating. One is what you might expect. Young people buying their first home, moving from renting to home ownership, and just don't want to take on or can't afford the entire payment for a house, but I can with my friends. So as long as we're renting together and we have all this chemistry, why don't we just make some money along the way, make some equity along the way? That's one side of the barbell. I think the other one that's been fairly interesting to me tends to be empty nesters, retirees, who don't necessarily need all the space anymore, need the size home. But rather than downsizing, probably in part because what you said relative to the interest rates, it's like, I'm going to sell this house, which I own outright potentially, or have a very low interest rate on, to move into a smaller unit with a very high interest rate. Like, I'll deal with the extra space until that. But that group tends to be a really good fit for these models too, where, you know, co-equity or co-buying or co-investment, they can share the monthly payment, the equity of moving either into a college town, moving closer to an urban center, or staying where they are and bringing in other tenants, other residents. So that's kind of interesting to see. It's like, for now at least, it's been two sides of the home buying and home ownership spectrum.
It's super interesting that you know, there's a lot of concern around institutional, you know, home buyers or investors, you know, both around, you know, the potential of them, you know, buying up what would be starter homes available to, you know, regular everyday, you know, home buyers, but also to the idea of, what's the exit strategy look like for these things? You know, is, you know, are these different models going to really be better for the market long term? And I think those same questions are applied here to these models. Like, how does this actually work out for folks? But when you think about it, you know, deciding between renting and buying, does it have to be an all or nothing thing where it's like, I'm either renting or I'm buying 100%? Like, isn't there some sort of fractional path to home ownership that doesn't involve needing to be a part of the 15% of Californians that can actually afford, you know, a median price home? Is there a way to just get into the game to where you as a regular person are able to make investments and compete against, right now, it seems to be more institutional investors?
Yeah, that's the right question, at least in my mind. When I was leading a strategy and innovation team at Rocket Mortgage, one of the things we always said was, let's use the right spark for the idea. What's your spark today? Or what are you going to spark? If we were working on a problem area, how we sparked that question would actually often lead us where to new ideas or new space. I think you just nailed it with that spark, which is this. Why does it have to be? I'll give you the example from shared equity. When you, even people in our industry, when you start talking about shared equity, almost everyone still immediately goes to one-to-one. Somebody is going to buy the entire amount of equity that I'm trying to sell. This idea that, oh, I'm going to own my home with one other institution or one other counterparty. And they still think of even the fractionalized piece as the same way we think about mortgage applications today, one borrower to one house. But that's not how the economy operates. It's not how most assets other than residential real estate operate. And so that's got to be where we're going, which is, you know, from a product mindset, from a product development mindset, how much of the house do you want to own? How much of a house do you want to buy? Do you want to buy the whole thing? We have a product for that called a mortgage. Great. You can buy the whole thing, 30-year fix. We know how to do that. But as soon as you say, like, well, I want to get in the game, do I have to buy the whole thing? Up until now, it's been immediately like, we don't know what to do with that. Where would we even put that question? How would we even form a product around it? And so I think you're asking the right thing, which is the new starter home, so to speak, might actually be the amount of equity I need for my financial plan. It might not be the size home that meets that amount. And I'll just use kind of round numbers. If I want my starter equity, my starter home to be $280,000, I don't think you need to go out shopping for a $280,000 home anymore. I think you should find a way with using these innovators and these platforms where you say, that's what I'm eligible for, that's what I'd like to go buy. And you find the unit or find the structure that fits where you're on a path to owning $280,000 of residential home equity on your schedule, which is 30 years or 20 or 15, whatever. And you're doing it in the context of a relationship or a product that lets you do that. And I personally think the investors that get sort of painted as the villain, let's be honest, they make a great villain, right? Like I'm in the Wall Street Journal, on TV, like institutional Wall Street buyers make great villains for the purposes of that story in that article. Mm-hmm. But the reality is there's a lot of people and organizations out there that would love to be on the equities side of the balance sheet in this market, right? That say, hey, I'm a pension fund for public school teachers. Can I own equity in teachers' homes? I would love to offset the cost that way, right? Mm-hmm. So instead of looking at it as it has to be a capital partner that needs 10x returns, 14x returns, the way these traditional REITs or traditional investors might look at it, it could be a fund or it could be an individual person who said, I just want to buy home equity one share at a time. You know, I use my Robinhood app to buy Ford Motor Company one share at a time. Can't I do that on the path to home ownership? Traditionally, no. I think in the future, the answer has to be yes. And that's kind of what gets me excited about this space is it flips that product question on its head and says, all right, let's get you earning wealth. Let's get you earning equity. And we'll do it on your, you know, on your speed. There's a bunch of people out there who would love to participate as well. We're going to bring everybody in together. That's why I think there is a relationship between the HEI, HEA platforms that you're talking about that buy mm-hmm. equity from existing homeowners and the ones that help first-time homeowners. We still in the industry are treating them as separate.
Yeah.
From a category perspective, a product, even from a disclosure perspective, we're often treating the first-time homebuyers like a mortgage, like it's a second lien, even though it's not. And so increasingly, the more we bring them together, you're just creating a market for an asset,
yeah.
an asset class. And I think that's got to alleviate some of the pressure here.
Super, super interesting to just kind of brainstorm on this stuff and think about it. And, you know, from my standpoint, from the valuation world, right, it puts mm-hmm. so much more pressure on needing accurate data, you know, accurate understanding of value, because the complexity of who's going to own that thing changes. So you need super transparent, portable understanding of what that home is and the value associated with it. That gets excited to me. It's like, how do we make sure that all the pieces, whether it's title, valuation, whatever, that need to work really well to allow innovators to dream a bit and and be freed up, if you will, to figure out solutions that help make home buying more affordable. So super fun to dream a little bit with you.
Thank you. And it's exciting. I can see how, you know, when you turn around and talk to your team, here's what I'm hearing out there, here's what I'm seeing. There, like, that's a really deep and meaningful question to ask. How do we deliver real-time data to homeowners that need it, to the investors who are going to invest in it, to the buyers who are about to make this giant decision, even if you're doing it fractionally or the yeah. traditional way? So when we think about, you know, what drives innovation, what drives excitement in this industry, and why, regardless of interest rates, we get excited about what's going on, it's questions like that. How do we turn around to providers like your team and your folks to say, all right, game on. How are we going to do this? How are we going to deliver this really critical data to the people who need it? Because that's the way we're going to get people in homes. That's the way we're going to create this opportunity, given all these other macro trends.
Super cool. Good to have you on.
Great to be here.
Looking forward to the next time, and we'll do another riff session and hopefully solve all of the universe's problems by the next episode. So,
Well, I look forward to talking about it, no doubt, but I'm here for it every time. So thank you.
Cool. Thank you.